It's a game of two halves, and in the end, Lionel Messi shines. After a stunning performance in Argentina's come-from-behind win against England, the 39-year-old securing the defending World Cup champions their second final in a row, much to the delight of organizers who last year understood Messi's star power when they bent the rules to include his Inter Miami side in the Club World Cup Championship. What legacy for the biggest World Cup ever, with its three countries, 64 teams, record ticket pricing? Will it be the on-field drama or the American-style packaging of the spectacle? What with commercial breaks disguised as water breaks, TV cutaways to celebrities during the action, and red cards overturned to please the hosts? What optics for the final? Will Donald Trump be flanked by Argentinian far-right ally Javier Milei and Pedro Sanchez, the prime minister of left-led Spain? He's threatened to cut ties with Spain. We'll look ahead to Sunday's final in New York and ask, when the dust settles, if football will ever be the same. Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at the legacy of the 2026 FIFA World Cup. With us, she was both a sports editor and a White House correspondent for us in previous lives. In her current incarnation, Ketevan Gorgestani is France 24 International Affairs Editor. Good to see you.
Hi.
With us as well, Eurosport journalist Ruben Slachter, not sporting his Curaçao jersey today.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. He's back from Nantes in Western France after attending multiple matches at this year's tournament. Renan Evin, Executive Director of Football Supporters Europe. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good evening.
And from Manchester, David Weber, Senior Sports Lecturer in Sports Business and Politics at the University Campus of Football Business. Welcome to the show.
Good evening.
On the go, you can listen to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Atlanta is not far from Florida, where Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon went searching for the Fountain of Youth, a certain smiling legend, leaving Georgia for the final in New York this Thursday morning after outrunning English opponents nearly half his age and proving that the fire in the belly is intact after all these years.
I've never doubted, and I knew that at the very least we would be among the final four, and that this group, when they come together, they produce something special from nothing, and the pain goes away, and they get in good physical shape, and they play like they did today, and never stop trying.
Ketevan Gorgestani, what to say? Two assists and running tackles again through the other team. It was incredible.
But Messi has been pretty incredible throughout this competition, and he is cementing his place as, if not the, at least one of the greatest. We're not going to get into the debate of the GOATs, but clearly Messi is displaying why he is Messi, helped very much also by a team that is there to play for Messi, and you see it. But the fact is that when he's not scoring, he's giving the assists. So it was really a demonstration from Leo Messi.
And remember that it was a come-from-behind win that broke English hearts on Wednesday. Same scenario as against Egypt with the Albiceleste rallying late.
The team plays best when we are facing a difficult situation with adversity. We had a challenging game, a challenging situation. There was blood in the water and we went for it.
Blood in the water, Ruben Slachter.
Yeah, that's some way to put it. But at least it was a real fight yesterday, that's for sure. Because, yeah, we saw it from minute one that England-Argentina is just way more than a game.
Yeah, a rugby match broke out at the beginning. I mean, the first 30 minutes were...
Yeah, they were both... I was honestly impressed with the English the first half, because I thought that that it would become such a game that it would be always for Argentina. But they managed to stand their ground. But then the second half, the football started. And unfortunately, after England scored, they also stopped playing. And yeah, that's also why they lost in the end.
All right. A rude awakening in London and Manchester this Thursday in the nation that invented modern football. The 60-year wait for another World Cup title continues. A curse? England's living on borrowed time German coach Thomas Tuchel doesn't think so.
I don't believe so much in an English thing and in a curse or whatever, or in like history repeating itself in these moments. It's just like it's different coaches, different players, different situations, different opponents.
David Weber, does the curse exist?
I'm not sure it's a curse. I think there's certainly a psychological block. England now have reached, now four semi-finals, and it seems to be just getting past those teams that know how to win. And Argentina know how to win. They've been there at this stage. They're such a compact, they play for each other. And I think, obviously, it's already been alluded to, once England had got that lead, it was almost as if they'd landed a punch on the school bully. And then it was like, oh, we're expecting that bully to come back at us now. So rather than take the game to Argentina again, Tuchel, you know, and England stepped back and invited the pressure on. And by the end, it was inevitable that there was only going to be one outcome.
Why did they do it?
I wonder whether it may perhaps a lack of self-belief. I mean, England have got the players to go out and attack. We've seen this in this World Cup. We've seen it in previous tournaments as well. England have got Harry Kane. They've got Jude Bellingham. They brought Marcus Rashford off the bench, who's in a rich vein of form. We've got players like Saka. England have got the players to attack any team in the world. But it was almost as if we don't believe we can actually do this. And it was like, well, if we're going to hang on here. And I think that was such a crucial mistake.
Ronan Evin, is the story of these semi-finals, come-from-behind win that Argentina did, sparked there by Lionel Messi, as we're saying, or that a team play that left France confounded?
Oh, I'm not sure I'm the best place to answer that question. I think we've seen a fantastic demonstration of team play of Spain that have changed the plans of France. I think the whole country here in France was already seeing that team winning, although a lot of people have changed their opinion quickly after that game. But it was a proper demonstration of football.
Were you expecting France to go all the way?
Well, it was certainly an entertaining team, an impressive team to see playing, but probably not enough of a team, as we've seen against Spain.
And so this third place match now against England, are you thinking about it, or you're just looking ahead to Sunday?
My opinion, but I think it's the one of a lot of fans, is that game shouldn't exist to start with. It doesn't exist at the Euro. It doesn't exist at most tournament. It is a bit of an oddity that you would have two teams with nothing to win. This is not the Olympics. There's no medal. So I understand that FIFA's position is to try to organize as many games as possible. But I think at that stage, everybody wants to go home, the players and the fans alike. So this is a game that shouldn't exist in the first place.
All right. And that brings us to sort of an assessment of what the whole tournament has been like. You touch on the money issue. There's the politics issue. We even saw it on the pitch on Wednesday evening in Atlanta, the British government urging FIFA to investigate Argentina's team after players displayed the Malvinas are Argentinian banner handed to them by fans in the stand. FIFA rules ban messages by players or federations of a political, ideological, religious, or offensive nature. We'll see if they enforce that ban. And Kedevan Gorgestani, it's a question as to whether they'll enforce it, seeing as there's been all these allegations that the rules have really gone Argentina's way.
Absolutely. And there have been precedents about political messages. I'm thinking back to Jerdan Shaqiri and Granit Xhaka, who did the Albanian Eagle celebration after a goal in front of the Serbian team. They got fined very quickly after that game. So technically, the Argentinian team should get fined at the very least because they displayed a political message. But to your point of all the allegations, look, the French were not playing Argentina, so I didn't have skin in the game. But every team who played Argentina had some calls that were made against them or for Argentina that were not called in other games in the same exact situation. There was that the stamp of Messi's foot on a player's shin that was not called a foul against Messi, and that gave a red card to another player in another game. You had overturned calls, the use of VAR that was in favor of Argentina to the point where there's a hashtag Vargentina, because a lot of people around the world believe that FIFA and that the refereeing has been favoring, in a way, Argentina. Whether that is true or just players and teams who are not happy and supporters who are not happy, it does seem that there are a lot of calls and situations that tend to favor Argentina. But I have to say that overall, my impression of this World Cup is that the refereeing in general was not good. There were a lot of mistakes, I believe, in this competition, and that did not involve Argentina.
Is that the case every 4 years, Ruben Slachter?
Yes and no. I mean, if we talk about Argentina, but yeah, and you're not asking it to a Dutchman, but if we talk about that famous quarterfinal in which also Messi should have been sent off 4 years ago, yeah, that's an issue. But what I've seen in this tournament and what for me is the real change is, I mean, we've always heard, and a lot of referees that are now retired have admitted it, that for FIFA it's super important that the big players are well protected, which is also normal because we come out of a time, I mean, I'm going way back to the Maradona era, when Maradona was just, yeah, he was
Jorginho, the defender.
All the defenders were just looking for him and to get him into the out of the pitch as fast as possible. So to a certain level, to protect them is good, but in this tournament, it has gone to another level, in my opinion. And, okay, yesterday I don't think that the ref was decisive. I found him poor, but not decisive. But, yeah, if you look for England, for example, they play in the first round against Ghana, when Ghana should have had a stonewall penalty and even maybe a red card for Jordan Pickford. So there's so many things that are happening, and what Ketevan says, I agree with it. Also, with the way we are using VAR, that's the whole issue. Because if you look back, for example, at all the Argentina versus Egypt incidents, I would say, oh, altogether, I mean, the decisions that were made with VAR were okay, but it's always in one way. And in the whole tournament, unfortunately, we can't say that there has been one decisive 50-50 decision gone against them. That's the only thing you can say.
Renaud Evin, you and I are both French. We can remember I can remember 1978 when the French were made an early exit at the World Cup in Argentina. Argentina, which needed 5 goals to go through to the final, and got 6 past Peru before playing the Netherlands. That was a very different time. Is it any worse today than it was back then?
No, I think football is a lot better regulated as it is now. I think what we've seen with the referees is largely FIFA not being prepared for the size of their own tournament. So more games, more pressure, and then unfortunately, but that's human nature. It's leading to a lot of conspiracies. All in all, this is what we've seen: referees that for the vast majority of them have done their best, but clearly the pool wasn't there for the increase of the number of games on this World Cup.
So you went to 4 matches at the tournament.
Yes, I believe so.
You were with us a few months back, expressing skepticism, particularly when you looked at the prices of the tickets. Were you happy you went?
I went to observe, to understand better the reality of this World Cup. It's hard to produce a definitive assessment of the quality of the organization. The reality is that FIFA and the US administration haven't necessarily produced the best organized World Cup, but the venues are so used to the high-level event, have such a professional staff, that in the end, they managed to pull it off. Now, the specificity of this World Cup is that every venue has been very different. The rules have been extremely different. But in the reality is that the people that had the chance to enter the US and to be able to buy a ticket had a relatively good time. Now, the other problem is that how many people have been left on the doorstep of this World Cup. What we understand is that a number of countries from Africa, from Asia, from South America, for those countries, the US has issued little to no visa for ticket holders. So if you take a country like Morocco, the fans we saw in the stadium were either US-based or had a dual citizenship or another passport than a Moroccan, because the reality is that there seems to have been some sort of a blanket ban on the entry into the US for the countries that needed a visa.
Yeah, David Weber, there was the concern even over that the sole player from the Haiti squad who got his visa at the 11th hour, the Somali referee who was barred from even coming for the tournament. This whole question of hosting an international sporting event. Remember, the U.S. is hosting the Olympics in a country that has draconian immigration rules. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just bringing back coming back to Cape Verde, the goalkeeper Vizinho, his mother couldn't be with him for his man of the match performance as well. So this has been a World Cup almost draped in kind of Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies and anti-immigration rhetoric as well. I think it's going to be even more problematic if we go forward in 2 years' time when Los Angeles is hosting the Olympic Games, because you're going to have far more people from far more countries right across the world trying to enter into the United States to watch and, of course, to participate as well. So I don't think that these stories of participants, of athletes, of officials, fans, spectators coming into the States, I don't think those stories are going to go away. In fact, they're probably going to get worse in the lead up and throughout the 2028 LA Olympics.
We've seen in the last days, Kedevan Gorgestani, ICE, you know, this immigration enforcement police, which has increased the number of arrests. There's been two fatalities in the last week. You agree there with David that this is a recipe for things to go very badly in Los Angeles?
I think there is definitely a risk. I do think that the administration toned it down during the competition. I think that everyone was talking about the risk so much that they didn't want the bad publicity to happen during the competition. And the arrests and the death that you saw had nothing to do, were not near the stadiums. There was a time when we were worried that there would be a widespread ICE presence around stadiums to pick up immigrants or people who looked like immigrants. That did not happen. But the overarching policy has not changed and will be stepped up now that the competition is over. And the way the administration talked about these countries, these teams coming, or those that they refused, also gives you an idea that they were doing it in broad daylight. The question of the Iranian team, who had to change its home base to Mexico because they weren't allowed to be in the United States, had to go back and forth, had half of their staff not allowed to get into the United States. When they got eliminated, the Department of Homeland Security Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen put out a public statement and said that he did a celebratory dance when Iran was eliminated and said, basically, we're happy to see them go. We never want to see them back here again. That is not what a country that is hosting usually does. And if that is the position that they have, as one of the guests said, when you have the whole world coming for the Olympics, and you have those sorts of comments coming from the administration, it doesn't make for a great atmosphere.
Yeah, Ronan Evin, what did you see in terms of how you were welcomed, how foreigners were welcomed?
Look, I have a French passport. I'm a man. I'm heterosexual. I'm white. I'm welcome in the U.S. So my experience is very different from a person coming from, let's say, Somalia, like the referee, or colleagues from Haiti or Iran that were not even able to get an appointment to apply for a visa, or LGBT plus fans, our colleagues from England, that decided not to travel because they didn't feel safe in the US, especially for transgender people. So my experience was fine. It was easy to enter into the country. It was expensive, but it was welcoming. But again, I am from a demographic that is welcomed by the current U.S. administration. I think for other regions of the world or people with another background, that's a very different story.
Now, you saw your matches in the stadium. We, of course, have been watching from here on television. Football purists will bemoan the way it's been filmed, the focus on celebrities in the crowds at matches. So did everyone in the 15th arrondissement bistro where I watched France-Spain on Tuesday, until Hollywood actor Timothée Chalamet realized he was on camera and vaunted his French team logo for the camera. Did you find yourself, I don't know, conflicted, Ruben Slachter? Oh, why are they cutting to the celebrities? Hey, that's Mick Jagger.
I go even worse being a chess player when I saw Magnus Carlsen with Norway, England. So yeah, the best thing about that was that nobody knew who he was except chess players. But okay, no, I find that really bad. And not only this, but also all the shots of fans in the stands who are so happy to be there, and it's.
And so few replays.
It's never.
You didn't see replays.
But okay, we are in America. Did we expect something else? It's about the show. There's a lot of show. The actors and especially the main protagonists, the big stars, are showing almost all up. So that's what's happening. It's way less about the football in itself, but it's all about just the whole show part. And okay, yeah, then we have a Hollywood person or in the stands, they're all super excited and et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, I don't like it, but it's also a bit of part where the tournament is held, right?
David Weber, is this the shape of things to come for the Champions League, for other tournaments? Are we now going to see, you know, the cameras panning to celebrities in the crowd at big matches? Are we going to have those quote-unquote water breaks, which are commercial breaks?
Yeah, I think UEFA will push back with the water breaks. But I think in terms of the celebrity, it's really interesting how this World Cup has been repackaged, or how it's repackaged soccer almost as a luxury product. This is about, it's about driving content, right? That these are hot tickets. These are matches that you want to be seen to be at. You know, we're talking about, you know, Coldplay, Chris Martin are on the screen there. This is a very celebrity-driven World Cup, and I don't think there's been a tournament quite like this. I think there's a nice contrast. I don't know if anybody on the panel has also been following Wimbledon. Wimbledon, we kind of do that all the time. You know, you see the celebrities in the royal box. I think David Beckham was sort of crisscrossing between the States and centre court. But you have this idea now that football is a luxury product. And I think Roland probably has some of his own thoughts on this. What that says is that is almost going to justify the price point of these tickets, which is bad news for the ordinary fan, because it drives up demand. FIFA, other football organisations are going to say, well, do you know what? This is a luxury product and we're going to price it accordingly.
I think there's one big difference, and you see it with the example of tennis. When they show the stars at tennis competitions, and the same is true for Roland Garros, when all the stars are coming, they show them when the game is not going on. That is the problem. The problem is in football. They panned at times when the ball was in action. There was sometimes some moments where you missed an action, a play, because they were showing sometimes a very famous person, sometimes a person that, if you were not American and you didn't know baseball, you probably did not recognize. So I think that, yes, the starification of football is going to continue, but I don't think that you're going to have it at the same scale, because I think in the United States, there was also this thing where all the stars, all the athletes from American sports wanted to be seen at the World Cup. I don't think they're going to make the trip to Spain or Portugal in 4 years, or to Saudi Arabia in 8 years to come and watch a game, because they're not there for the football. Some others, like Timothée Chalamet, who actually likes football, will probably be there. But so I think, yes, it's a preview of things to come, but maybe not to the scale, because this is the United States. And they really packaged it like a U.S. sport, where you have a lot of breaks in basketball, in baseball, in American football. You have breaks during the game where they are idle and you can pan to the crowds or to the stars or take commercial breaks. It's not how football is made.
Right. It's not how football is made. Renan Evin, your thoughts on this, having attended the tournament, and would you include, by the way, in those stars, we talked about Lionel Messi at the beginning of the show. We talked about past his prime Cristiano Ronaldo, who was still in the Portugal squad. Is the game more and more going to be about the stars and less about the teams?
I don't know. I mean, this is still a fantastic, despite of every criticism and every bad decision FIFA has made, this is still a fantastic tournament and it's still exciting to see what's happening on the pitch. So I'm really struggling to see the point of showing some very famous, some remotely famous people in the stands. We've seen that FIFA has tried a lot to promote social media influencers as well, which is genuinely weird. So And not forgetting that the person that we've seen the most on camera is FIFA president himself. He's been shown that every game he attended
and
twice a day during the group stage and at every halftime. So I don't know. I think broadcasters are a bit uncomfortable with that. I mean, when you were watching French TV, the commentators didn't know half of the time who were the celebrities in question. I'm not sure it's there to stay. I don't think this is something that has been imposed top down because by the US organizers of the World Cup. I think it's rather FIFA that has tried to copy what they think their perception of US sport, but it didn't really work. What we will remember of this World Cup is just what's happening on the pitch as any other World Cup. So I think this Americanization of sport will not survive. Maybe that's a wishful thinking. But football is the most popular reason in the world for sport in the world for a reason, and it doesn't need to copy U.S. sport. It needs to stay true to what it is. The product is good enough.
All right. So Ronan seeing the glass half full there, but he does mention Gianni Infantino appearing on camera, beginning, middle, and end of getting booed. He didn't seem to mind too much. This after, particularly, the boos got louder after red card gate, FIFA obliging the U.S. president by lifting a red card against Team USA striker Follerin Balogun. Belgium still thrashed the host 4-1, but not after furia among fans. Again, is that a parenthesis, Ruben Slachter, or is that a precedent and we're going to see more red card gates?
I'm very afraid that it will be in some way present, but it's not the first thing, of course, because we come in a year with an AFCON that was rewarded to another country 3 months after they lost the final. And there is the debate is getting further and further now. I mean, for Balogun, I will say it, that it's a wrong decision to turn it back. Not because the red card was right or not, because even you can discuss it, but now you're touching the rules of the game, and that's very, very dangerous for the future.
Yeah, so, David Weber, we're living in an age of growing inequality. Is football just a mirror of that, and that now the high and mighty get to make their own rules?
Yeah, absolutely. I think most of us on the call would probably agree, if not all of us on the call would agree, that football always reflects the society in which it's played. And football is always a prism for that. This feels like, and I think with the trajectory of the World Cup in particular, you know, in future tournaments and perhaps culminates in Saudi in 8 years' time, where the wealthy essentially, you know, pull the levers as to say they get the decisions that they want to make. Now, that's not to say that there can't be any pushback. And I think that we've got to realize that there is some sort of, if football isn't democratic itself, there is a democratic impulse. So we have, for example, Ronan's, the head of the Football Supporters and Europe Association, there are these bodies that will hold football's governing bodies to account. And I think that's very, very important. And it's important then that fans recognise that, get on board with this and say, well, you know, this is our sport. We make football what it is. Football is nothing if it's not the people's game, and it cannot be taken away by presidents, whether those are presidents of FIFA or whether those are presidents of host countries. This is our game and it belongs to us. And I think that we've got to realize, we've got to kind of hope that there's this pushback against this, against this kind of elitism.
Yeah, and we can talk also about the way it's consumed. We talked about the television. A lot of it now is more and more headlines that we read in the next morning, particularly if the matches are at 3 a.m. European time. And these global events play out more and more with highlight reels, and they play out on social media. So when Norway fans do the row at the airport on the way home, spot the security guy, he's pretty good.
Oh my God.
And he joins in. Well, that goes viral, understandably so. Is this what people will remember from the World Cup, Gedevan Gorgeous-Dani?
I hope in a way that all the problems and the Americanization of the sport, the intervention of Infantino and Trump, is not going to eclipse completely the fact that I was surprised at how good the atmosphere and how much the United States sort of got into it, got in on the fun with the foreign fans. You had, as we just showed, the Norwegians, but you had also those images. And let's not forget that it was not only the United States, it was also Canada and Mexico. But remember those images of the South Korean fans who were trying to get into the stadium with a bottle of tequila and then got stuck and were surrounded by Mexican fans and decided to down the bottle with the fans before they all got in, and then they were all dancing to Gangnam Style. You had all of these mixes of cultures and countries, and that is part of the joy of the World Cup. And I hope that this social media aspect is going to sort of keep that part alive, all those beautiful images that we saw, sort of maybe not overshadow all the problems, but at least compensate and the reels of the beautiful goals that we saw throughout the competition, that will stay also and not just the bad stuff.
Ruben Slaughter, is social media the friend of football or perhaps the enemy of football?
It can be both.
Because we live in an age of short attention spans and
yeah,
this doesn't help.
No, that doesn't help. But well, like Edwin says, there has been also good examples, but that's always the case. I mean, we're here in Paris. I think we all remember 2 years ago being here for the Olympics and the atmosphere. That was just incredible. I've never seen Paris like this. So there has been also a part of it. What is just a pity, and what is the beauty of the tournaments, I've been lucky to be into a few World Cups and European Championships as well, is the whole mixture of all people. And that's, of course, what will remain a bit, that this was, of course, the tournament of the happy few who could afford to go there. So you have a different kind of crowd, which, well, I find it a pity. But yeah, about social media, I still think that, the short things, and then we're properly talking about the game itself. Yeah, that's not helping, in my opinion. But if you talk about all these beautiful little stories, yeah, then it works very well to really... yeah, share very quickly those beautiful...
Ronan-Yvan, among the matches you went to was France-Senegal. When you were there, obviously you saw... did you see this communion? Particularly because, yeah, the stadium, the tickets were expensive, but you had fan zones in the city. And were able to mix with the Senegalese diaspora to speak with people from other countries?
Yeah, I think the reason we talk so much about the Scots and the Norwegian is that it's two of the very few countries that travel in big numbers because of their high purchasing power, because they come from countries that don't participate so often in the World Cup. Now, of course, as we get to the quarterfinals or semifinals, there are bigger contingents of French or English, but the Norwegians were pretty special here. France-Senegal, well, Senegal is on blacklist. Is on the blacklist of the Trump administration. So there was absolutely no one except for the players coming from Senegal. There were some Senegalese fans from the diaspora established in the US, and there was a little bit of an atmosphere, but nothing comparable to what it would have been if the fans from Senegal would have been let into the country. So I think we've seen colorful stadiums, but it's a lot down to A, the diasporas, and B, the fact that, yes, the American audience bought into the hype of the World Cup, bought jerseys, went wore colors to go to the stadiums, and in the end gave the illusion of an atmosphere inside the stadium. But to a very few exceptions, including Norway, it's been a fairly sad World Cup.
And as you allude to, the Scots drinking Boston dry. Another game-changing innovation to look forward to for Sunday's final at the MetLife Stadium in New Jersey outside New York, an NFL-style halftime show. Officially, Madonna, Shakira, Justin Bieber and friends will only be on stage for 11 minutes. But add to that the time it takes to roll in and out the stage, the time it takes for broadcasters to run commercials, and highlights, after all, it is a football match from the first half. Have you done the math, Kedavan Gorgestani? Is that going to be 15 minutes?
No, it's absolutely not going to be 15 minutes. And if we have any viewers of the Super Bowl among our viewers, then they know that it's not. The halftime shows at the Super Bowl, they're always about 12 minutes. But then you add at least a whole 10 or 12 minutes extra for the setting up the stage, removing the stage. So this is going to be at least about 25 minutes. They can't do it within 15 minutes. The only example, but given the number of people who are going to be performing, I doubt that's going to be it, is that the Club World Cup, remember, there was a halftime show, but they did it in the stands, meaning there wasn't the time of rolling it out on the field and taking it back out. They had set up a section of the stands to perform there so as to not go over the 15 minutes. But I think that with the hydration breaks, it's probably the worst thing, because if they really do go to 25 or 30 minutes, not only are they going against the FIFA rules, but just think of the players who are in the dressing rooms waiting for half an hour. What do they do? Do they have another pitch on the side where they can go and train? They can't run around for 30 minutes in their dressing room. It's too long for players. Will they have to sort of re-warm up a little bit after? It just becomes complicated. But I guess we'll see. If none of the teams complain, then maybe they're fine with it.
Ruben Slachter?
Yeah, well, again,
what do you do during a long break like that?
Yeah, well, I worked for 5 years at the Stade de France, and in the Stade de France, next to the changing room, there's this whole warm-up room where you can do it if you want to. But yeah, of course, it's also different because that's what you do before a game, and now it's during a game you go off the pitch. Yeah, we'll see. Again, yeah, the whole concept of a halftime show, again, yeah, well, like I said before, we are in the United States. For me, that's not the end of the world. But when it will take until 30 minutes, yeah, then of course it will have an influence on the game, like those hydration breaks or whatever you want to call them. It has just had a huge influence. If you've seen how many matches have been transformed after those hydration breaks,
which is the momentum, yeah.
Which is normal, of course, because coaches can step in. And unfortunately, we had many coaches who made a lot of very bad decisions during those hydration breaks. But yeah, if it has a real influence on the game, yeah, it's a very bad thing.
All right, we talked about Argentina at the outset, of course, with that gritty come from behind win. But how about Spain, La Roja? Welcomed late Wednesday to their hotel in Montclair, New Jersey. That's in the suburbs of New York City, ahead of Sunday's final at the MetLife Stadium. And again, they're sort of going against the grain, as we said earlier, Ronan et Vin, the Spanish, because, they have big-name players. Yamil Lamán comes to mind, of course, the 19-year-old phenom. But it's really the team play in their instance. That's not the FIFA business plan.
No, certainly not. I think it's a different story than the one that is being told around Argentina or France. But look, this is football. This is it's an exciting team to see playing. It's not a team of superstar, but that shows that it's not the most important in football. So looking forward to seeing them on the pitch on Sunday.
Who are you going to be looking out for, Kedavan Gorgestani?
Looking out or hoping that they win?
No, but what's going to make the difference? Again, this team play,
I actually want to see the Argentines face a team that doesn't give up for the last 30 minutes and a team that is on their level, because they haven't been tested that strongly up until now. And they've always waited until the last minute to score goals in the 80th minute, in the 90th minute on flamboyance. Spain is the best defense of this competition. I mean, they are rock solid in the back. So I would like to see the way I would have loved to see the French actually play their game against Spain, to see them go head to head on their best. I hope that the best Spain team actually shows up, to see whether or not the Argentines can actually face a real strong, organized, full-on defense, and whether Messi's brilliance actually can make it through these guys.
David Weber, do you concur?
I do. I think he's got that absolutely spot on. I think if Argentina win on Sunday, they'll have entirely justified that those back-to-back World Cups. I don't think Spain will play or will set up like either France or indeed England have. I think there really will be a sense that Spain are that good. Maybe there is a narrative that this is the handing over of Messi's crown to Lamine Yamal. I mean, there is that kind of image that's going around social media at the moment. Whether that this is that moment where Messi comes to the end of his career, this is Yamal's moment to step up. He's had a relatively quiet tournament. The final would be a really great time to step up and say, you know what, I'm the new kid on the block here. My gut is that I think Spain will do it on Sunday. I think as good a side as Argentina are, I don't think Spain will allow Argentina to get away with playing the way that they've been playing over the last few games.
Yeah, Lamine Yamal, who practices his football at Barcelona like Messi did for so many years. Ronan Evin, mm-hmm. Of course, the club team that will have the most players on the pitch is Atletico Madrid. It's got something like 11 players, if you count from both sides.
That's certainly impressive. I think that also shows the dominance of European football. Gianni Infantino has been very keen to promote this World Cup as football getting truly global with all these new nations and so on. The reality is that the majority of the teams qualifying beyond the round of 16 were European, and even a team like Argentina is predominantly European in terms of where the players are. So what we see with this new format, this extended format, and now FIFA talking about 64 teams, is that in the end, yes, there are a few more guests to the party, but a concentration of wealth and power remains within a few countries and clubs.
Ruben Slaughter, you have the honor of the final word. A prediction, please, sir.
I think that Spain will win, but it will be a very difficult game because Argentina will go for the fight. So I think it will be 2-1 for Spain.
All right. There's a precise prediction from Ruben Slaughter. I want to thank you, one of the Kedevan Gorgestani, David Weber for being with us from Manchester, Ronan Evin from Nantes. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.